everything to tabulate it and get it up there, as well as care for those that have the MS as well, maybe at home, maybe at work. We have to communicate regularly in all forms. We're doing it now. We don't go away and do nothing for the next year. We've got to get some more of these questions out to our patients, out to our public, get the newest information there. The Crohn's disease trial is showing very positive signs. I've already told gastroenterologists in Ireland about that. They're still quite sceptical. It's a condition that makes people very afraid of change because there's a great variation in the type of patient. But one thing's for sure, when you've experienced a young female needing a colostomy at such an age and otherwise very vibrant and very healthy looking, you're very reluctant to change anything. You go with the convention and you try to hit them hard and fast. And I often wonder, you know, if we stuck our necks out and tried something like LDN, would they be better off for it? But it's a big risk, you see, because you know these patients are going to worsen quite rapidly. And are they going to blame you if you use anything other than the recommended drugs at the recommended doses? We've got to collate our information. That means we're going to have to start talking in other languages as well. You know, we're lucky that the United States is mostly English, though I was in Orlando last summer and the Spanish was very necessary, I have to say. Likewise, in my hometown, our population is about 10,000, but 2,500 now are Brazilian. There's been a large influx of manual workers, so I had to learn Portuguese as well and translate all the pharmacy computers into Portuguese directions. It's good to get the right side of the braid going. We need to report our findings, and we need not be negative. I often think a negative report is twice as valuable as a positive one because you don't get the euphoria of the positive result. You don't go, hallelujah, this drug works. You have to say, oh, that's disappointing. You then have to let the scientists kick in and say, why do we think it didn't work? You know, is there a reason? Is there a male-female bias, for example? That's a question I hear a lot because there are issues about prolactin, as one speaker mentioned earlier. There are issues about hormonal change. And age groups, Pat was pointing out the most common age group to be diagnosed. Certainly there's a female majority in the patients we see, but then we have the fertility patients skewing it as well. But we do know what each patient is. The MS is 2-to-1, it more or less generally is. The last thing we need to do is continue lobbying. That sounds easy, but we need to lobby even to get the respect of the compounder maintained. And that's no easy job these days. I mean, just recently you may have seen the news about the compounders losing the right to dispense a very, very expensive drug used off license again for macular degeneration. The pharmaceutical companies won out on their battle to stop them from buying it. In Europe, you don't even have the argument. They just will not sell you the drug. If I ring up DuPont or any of the manufacturers of naltrexone and say, will you sell it to me? They just say, no, go away. So we got to lobby, we got to keep at it. And the good thing about Europe is that we now have individual member states and you can lobby local EU members. Every state is allowed to write its own sub-law. So although prescription medicines may have a generalized rule that they all have the same classification, you're allowed to have, for example, compounding or whatever done in each member state. They can write their own rules. So we've got to lobby and we've got to encourage other countries to do the same. The UK is well on the way as well. Spain has produced a liquid form of naltrexone, a stable liquid form that's available on prescription, on their prescription schemes. I haven't seen too much of it around, but I do know it exists. It's been manufactured in England. The negativity. People talk about past experiences and stories, mainly prescribers, and this is the reason for not prescribing it. You know, oh, I tried it once, but the patient got worse, so I never went near it again. You're always going to get some who don't improve. There's always going to be. There's always going to be failed cases, unfortunately. The lack of understanding and the lack of knowledge is by far the most pervasive of the negative attitudes we see towards it. There's just not enough information in mainstream yet. The perceived exaggeration is something I am very want to avoid. We're good at it here because we know it's very good. But if we sing too much, people will just cover their ears. It's like repeated stress disorder. You might get in a joint when you run a marathon. The more you talk about something, the more they don't want to hear about it. So it has to be subtle and well-informed and scientific. The low usage rates of the drugs doesn't encourage its use. You know, it's a negative feedback as well. If there's not a lot of patients on it or not a lot of prescribers talking about it, there's very few people willing to take the risk. Everyone here is a risk taker. Anyone who decides to go on the drug, anyone who decides to dispense it, anyone who decides to prescribe it, we're all taking risks. We're sticking our necks out, but we know why. Sometimes you have to dare to achieve. There's the fear of the unknown, as I said already. I mentioned the exaggeration already. I won't dwell on it. Finally, I want to show you a picture I took a few weeks ago. Again, you wonder, what the hell has this got to do with naltrexone? Well, on the left of the picture, you'll see a very old method of using wind power. And on the right of the picture, you'll see a very new method of using wind power, which just proves to me, and it should prove to everyone else, that you should never throw away the old. You should never think one thing is only used for one thing and that only. There are always new ways to develop energy, new ways to develop thinking. And there's two sides to every story. And I think we all have a lot to learn by continuing to preach this message to the professionals that are involved in the treatment of who are, after all, very vulnerable patients. Thank you for your time.
I have a two-part question. One, and this could be answered by Skip, maybe. If we're having trouble absorbing oral, why can't you do a drop or sublingual naltrexone?
Why not? Liquid, there's a liquid form of it already, and it contains a small amount of alcohol.
You can make it into a troche, though, too, or a troche.
Yeah, and there's a transdermal. There are transdermal forms of it as well. Yeah.
The second thing is on fertility, is it used for PCOS or just any type of fertility in general, unexplained?
Again, it seems to be one of these drugs that works across a large spectrum. PCOS would be one-third of the patients we see, and we have 400 fertility patients.
Of course, endometriosis, I know that Dr. Boyle's talked about before. He still uses it. For male infertility, is it for only those that have low sperm counts or just the couple can't get pregnant, so you put the male and female both on the low dose?
The patients we see there are mainly people that have follicular stimulation issues or that they have some sort of underlying chronic fatigue issue. Again, it seems to be the follicular, so it would be low sperm count, but only low sperm count due to spermatogenesis problems, not that caused by industrial pesticides or other external
low motility, abnormal sperm heads,
that's
things
right,
like that.
That's
okay.
Right.
Anybody using it for ALS?
AOS?
ALS, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, which is Lou Gehrig's disease.
We have one lateral sclerosis patient. He's getting worse quite rapidly. So his walk has disimproved a lot. Other symptoms, he has no other symptoms except he's losing the motor, the legs, really. So I can't say it's positive or negative. There's no improvement in his motor symptoms, that's for sure.
Anybody else in the room have experience with ALS?
Coming off his respirator for 6 hours a day, and that's been for over a year. About 6 months ago, he got pneumonia, so it put him back full-time on the respirator, but once he got over it, he's back to coming off about 6 hours a day, and he's able to communicate with his wife now by voice rather than by sign language, and he hadn't been able to do that in years.
How about the other guy?
The other guy was 80 years old when he was diagnosed with ALS. His daughter told me that within a month of his starting to use this, he was dressing himself again. And I talked to my doctor who is treating him, and he has progressed some since then, but it slowed down markedly after he started the LDN. It's not keeping it from progressing, but it has slowed it down a good bit. So both of those are positive experiences, I think. I don't think it's going to cure them by any means, but they are using it.
Yeah, we have a suspicion in Ireland that a lot of the motor neuron and sclerosis diagnoses are confused, that the diagnostic systems are not as high level as they would be here. It's quite a treat to get an MRI, you know. It's quite a treat to get any of the scans done for a patient who would be on the government drug system. So they don't occur frequently, and there are often misdiagnoses. I know Pat didn't mention this, but he has a theory that Lyme disease may be getting confused with MS quite a lot in Ireland. They don't believe it exists in Ireland. We believe it does. And there is every reason why it should be sent, blood should be taken and the samples should be sent to Germany or the States to get them verified. I honestly believe it could well be Lyme disease, and that would explain the rocky rural areas that have a higher incidence of supposed MS, because we have a lot of indigenous deer, a lot of them.
Hi. I've never spoken to a microphone before. I hope I'm doing okay. My name is Aletha, and I'm on the Yahoo chat site that Dr. Gluck has put together for LDN. And we have a lot of things that we notice just from the sheer amount of people that get on, the problems they have, the difficulties. And two of the ones that you mentioned are nausea and, I forgot what the other one is.
Sleeplessness?
Well, the sleeplessness doesn't seem to change, but the nausea changes a lot. Oh, headaches. Headaches and nausea with just filler change.
Yeah.
So I was wondering what fillers you're using, and yeah, do you change them at all when they have those problems?
We listened to our patients from the start about that there was a big negativity towards calcium carbonate, which in itself didn't seem to be logical to a pharmacist because it dissolves in stomach acid. But the more we looked into it, we realized it is constipating, it does cause nausea, it has its own effects in affecting the absorption of other drugs and minerals. So we thought, maybe they have a point, maybe they know more than we know. They're only reporting what they feel. So we went with Avicel, the microcrystalline cellulose. We have no other filler, we don't use anything else. We use the marker, riboflavin, B1, at a very low dose, just an extremely low level, just to colour the powder enough to make it obvious what dilution you've made and to make sure the powder is evenly mixed.
And what are you using, Dr. Skip? Okay.